Brought to you by Black Knight, it's the technology.ie podcast, episode 9 for Thursday, November 24th, 2011, with Michaela Nealon and Conor Muinichon. Hello and welcome to the technology.ie podcast in the technology.ie studios. I'm Conor Muinichon, and in his office at Black Knight HQ in Carlo, it's Michaela Nealon. Hello, Michaela.
How's it going, Con?
Also joining us from Berlin this week, Irish novelist and computer game author Julian Goff. Hi, Julian.
How are you doing?
Thanks for coming on the show. Later on the show, we'll be talking about the new release of Minecraft and Julian's role in that. Also talking about intellectual property, SOPA and Protect IP. Have you heard about them? There are two bills being debated in the United States which could lead to an American internet censored according to the demands of copyright holders. And we'll also talk about some of the other items making news this week. Coder Dojo here in Ireland, Google Music launched but not here in Ireland, real-time analytics launched by Google, and we'll find out more about Black Knight's new cloud hosting product launched last week. First though, I want to talk about two good news Irish tech stories, which very briefly we'll just touch on these. The first of these, we'll put a link in the notes on technology.ie to the story. This is an Irish Times story we're linking to. PayPal to create 1,000 jobs, but they haven't decided, Michaela, if it's going to be in Dundalk or Limerick yet. It's good news, though. It's their call centre jobs, and it's positive, would you say?
Look, any job creation story at the moment is positive.
Okay.
And both Dundalk and Limerick could do with the jobs.
Absolutely.
There's no doubt about it. I mean, Limerick was very, very hard hit when Dell pulled out.
Yeah. Which, as I was talking to someone earlier on today as well, pointed out that Dell didn't pull out entirely, and there are still a lot of people employed by Dell in Limerick. But certainly the kind of jobs that were lost haven't been replaced in Limerick. But maybe these call centre jobs could do something to help that. We still have to wait and see whether these jobs, as we say, go to Dundalk or to Limerick. As you point out, Michaela, they'll be badly wanted wherever they actually turn up. But another thing,
at least they're not going to Dublin.
At least they're not going to Dublin, which I think is true. I think Dublin has enough in relation to those kind of jobs. So the next story, though, we're going to link to as well. The jobs are based in Dublin. They're a different class of job, and it's an Irish startup. But the people behind it are all Belarusian. Did you see that link we put into the notes there for you? I've linked to a story on New Tech Post, which is about a new company called Profitero, which is an interesting one in terms of what they're doing, which is getting market intelligence for businesses, surveying other businesses and what people are selling products and services for at different prices around the world. But what's interesting is that, as I say, the guys behind it are Belarusian, and one of them would have come to Ireland on the Chernobyl Children's Project and visited one family in particular. I was reading about this, I think, in either the Sunday Business Post or the Sunday Times at the weekend, where he said that he learned his entrepreneurship because from actually coming to stay with an Irish family. Did you see that story, Michaela?
Well, I didn't see that particular story.
Yeah.
I think it's fascinating to see now that we're getting to the point where, you know, you're having non-Irish nationals actually going off setting up interesting businesses over here. I mean, if you think back to the 90s, the early 90s, I mean, you know, everybody you met on the street was Irish.
Yeah.
Now there's lots of different nationalities. I think it's great.
Well,
a few of our clients would be based in Ireland, but not actually Irish. And that's something, you know, that has only changed over the last couple of years.
Well, it's one
so
of the,
this is good news.
It's one of the recurring themes we've had on this program, Michaela, which is, I suppose, admiring and envying the success of Silicon Valley. And one of the things they try to do very well over there is attract immigrants with entrepreneurial inclinations. And it's great to see that finally happening here in Ireland. What do you think, Julian?
Well, I think that's we've actually got a really good opportunity in the downturn in Ireland to actually bring those people to the country. Because I think, you know, at the height of the Celtic Tiger, Ireland was not the most attractive place for a young, hungry, you know, East European entrepreneur to go to, because it was so incredibly expensive to just to live, or to hire anyone, or to you know, rent an office. The downturn, you know, all the empty commercial property and the lowering of the cost of living, it actually we really could use that to bring a lot of startups to Ireland, because with the low tax rate, you know, it's a very attractive place to set up your headquarters if you want to grow a small company. We just don't have all the other bits in place. I mean, Silicon Valley has that critical mass of people where everybody drives on everybody else, and it's hard to get that in Ireland. So hard to know where you'd put it. You know, Dublin isn't really a very suitable place for an alternative.
But it's interesting.
But I think there's a huge opportunity there, yeah.
Yeah, you're talking about that kind of clustering effect, Julian, and it's interesting to see, though, that in many ways, you know, maybe that is to be found in Dublin. And there's a very good write-up on this on newtechpost.com, which we'll link to. But one of the founders of the company has pointed out that they have, because they have Belarusian, I suppose, heritage, and that's where they're from, they've been to college, I think, in Dublin, and this is a spin-off, I think, from some work that they've done in college in Dublin as well. But because of the fact that they have cultural links, I suppose, with Eastern Europe, they have been invited and to consider moving to elsewhere in Europe. And they've pointed out that they're very comfortable in Ireland. They say Ireland is a good location for startup business, and they say that they're being very well looked after by Enterprise Ireland. The next story I want to talk about is on our agenda today is specifically in relation to something which I think is something you perhaps have an interest in as a creative artist, Julian. And I know that you and I were discussing this last night. Two bills, one in the Senate and one in the House of Representatives in the United States, being developed. One is called SOPA, the Stop Online Piracy Act, and the other one is called Protect IP. And Michele, the general consensus seems to be that these are, I suppose, prompted by the kind of lobbying that Hollywood, and I mean Hollywood in a general sense, not just the movie industry, but also the music industry in the United States, have tended to do in Washington. And there's a general consensus among technologists and many other people that these are a bad idea.
It's an interesting and messy issue. I mean, the reality is that there are issues that need to be addressed in terms of piracy, intellectual property theft, fraud, all of those things. And it's not just a case of Hollywood moaning about, you know, cutting into their profits. I mean, there's also some very serious things involving fake pharma as well. And the fake pharma stuff is very, very real and very, very scary.
What do you mean? People selling drugs that aren't what they claim to be, is it?
Yes, but it's much more than that. I mean, If you think, like, say, for example, you know, you go into a pharmacy in Ireland or in Germany or wherever, and you go in, you buy something over the counter, it's not going to kill you. But because of the way things are in the US, it's attractive for people to buy certain medicines or types of medicines through some of these websites, and it'll literally kill you. Because they're not actually the drugs. They could be cut with something or mixed with something, so you could basically end up, well, dead.
Yeah.
That's not a specific. I mean, you might as well ban the postal service because they have to be delivered by post. It's not a specifically internet problem. And I think the bills that they're bringing in are highly misjudged in terms of dealing with that particular kind of issue. They're way too broad spectrum. You know, I mean, SOPA in particular is it just doesn't seem to understand what the internet is.
Yeah.
You know, well, this is so part of the problem. I mean, you can't say what they're trying to do is inherently wrong. It's how they're trying to do it.
Yeah, so your point is, Michele, that there are legitimate concerns, whether it's about fake pharma or whether it's about intellectual property theft and copyright infringement. But the approach, it's as you both point out, the broad kind of blunt approach that's been taken here is get these websites offline, take them off. And what's specifically being proposed here, and it's similar to the three strikes kind of thing that's been going on in jurisdictions all over the world as well. But what's specifically being proposed here is that infringing websites, and by infringing we mean allegedly infringing websites, because there doesn't seem to be a due process here, there doesn't seem to be a court case involved, but someone can allege that there is copyright infringement going on a website, and that website, Michele, then gets delisted in DNS. That host name will not be resolved by American DNS servers. They're obliged, if these laws were passed, to actually take those servers off, which essentially is blocking those websites and censoring the internet.
Well, it's actually much worse than that, Colm.
Why?
Yeah.
com.net.org/info/biz and several other ones, other extensions, are run by US-based companies. So it's not just a case of all the US ISPs having to block or remove the domains from their DNS. You're talking about having the domain, you know, the kill switch. So you're talking about, say for example, if I was to have, let's say, some kind of .com website domain, whatever, set up that was infringing on the rights of, you know, some company or whatever, they could get the domain name pulled completely by VeriSign. Of course, the counter argument is that there's nothing to stop them from switching to using, say, a .co.uk or a ., you know, whatever, some other extension, which the Americans don't have full control over.
But equally, those domains might, are, you know, even those international domains .co.uk or .ie or anything else, if you are depending on, let's say, providing a service of news, information, content, whatever it may be, to an audience, and if a large proportion of that audience is in the United States, you might find that their local ISP DNS will no longer resolve your domain, Michaela. You're losing a significant amount of business on essentially what is hearsay. I understand what they're trying to do here, but is there, you know, you mentioned, for example, Julian, that this is a blunt instrument and a blunt way to do it. I want to ask you, Michaela, specifically as the technologist, as the website hosting company, what do you think we should do? Should it be possible to block websites, first of all, on principle? Should we be blocking websites at all, no matter what kind of content they have?
Yeah, well, that's a question, all right. I mean, I'm on the record as saying, well, basically no. I don't believe in it. I think blocking any kind of content can do as much harm as it can do good, because by kind of blocking it and shoving it under the carpet doesn't actually make it go away.
In fact, it's very easily circumvented, isn't it?
Well, yeah, and it's like kind of ignoring it doesn't mean it doesn't happen. So just because you don't see it doesn't mean that it's not happening to somebody else. It's like there's a lot of legislation that gets pushed through various bodies, be it Congress in the US, the European Commission, even the Doyle in Dublin. And you just kind of, you're there and you're kind of going, okay, well, I understand why they're doing it, but I don't really understand why they're doing it this way and why on earth didn't they talk to us first?
Well, you get the very strong impression that most of the politicians debating these bills don't actually understand the technology. They fundamentally don't understand what they're talking about. So it makes for very, very bad bills, because essentially the lobbyists can almost write the bills for them. I mean, the level of understanding that's in the discussions of this bill, I mean, very poor from the politicians.
Julian, you're the creative artist here. You're the novelist. You're the songwriter. I mean, these lobbyists claim to represent you. Do they? Let me ask you: Have you? I mean, what's your feeling on your content being pirated?
I'm fairly relaxed about it. I mean, you know, the kind of pirating that I get would be very, you know, low key stuff. It'd be people copying or downloading it and copying for themselves or some friends. It's not commercially exploitative, and I'm pretty chilled out about it. The fundamental problems here are an old industrial model based on physical products, and an old copyright model based on whatever it was based on originally, that's coming into collision with a technology that completely runs at right angles to that. Everything changes when you digitize product. The pricing model, the business model, the distribution model, the marginal cost of each item. Absolutely everything changes, but the copyright law and the corporate frameworks haven't changed. So they're just in fundamental conflict. And these laws that they're trying to bring in are attempts to solve solve the problem in such a way as to not change the existing industries and not change the existing copyright laws. Mm. But I think that's the wrong way around. I think you have to acknowledge that digitization fundamentally changes the relationship between the producer, the distributor, the consumer, the art, the artist, the reader, the viewer, and an attempt to maintain the legal status quo by legislation is going to be disastrous. It's like outlawing it's like outlawing steam to protect the horse industry.
So we need to
have to come to terms. I think we need to change copyright law. I think a lot of laws do need to be changed, but this method of just supporting everything the way it always has been, with really blunt tools like the FOPA, is not going to work.
It's really interesting, though. I mean, when you think of the kind of things that legislation should be passed about in relation to the internet, and the kind of it's extraordinary to think of the power of this lobby in Washington and here in Ireland as well. We've had the three strikes implemented as a ministerial directive in this country. How do you feel as an artist, Julian, because the first thing that the music industry and entertainment industry representatives do when they get up, they say, is we're doing this for the artists. We're doing this to help artists feed themselves and their families so that they can continue to create art, and so that we can continue to foster new talent. Is that valid? How do you feel when you hear that?
It's half true, but most people are trying to protect their profit margins. I mean, it is a very turbulent time. I mean, my own publisher and I have these conversations because we're very interested in the pros and cons of this new world. And we've tried out some interesting things ourselves just to see what would happen, because nobody knows what's going to work in the new environment. Like we did a trust edition of my last novel, which is a PDF. Fully of the finished, print. It's the same quality PDF that we printed the book off, so it's full quality. And I think we just lowered the resolution on some of the pictures, or the file would have been just huge.
Yeah.
But we let people download it for nothing from my publisher's website, and then pay for it afterwards by PayPal, whatever they thought it was worth, as a kind of an experiment, because we had a book in a competition where it was going to be very difficult for people to actually read the book in time to vote in the competition. So we thought, well, how about we just let them read the book for nothing, we just email it to them if they want it, or they download it themselves from the website if they want it. So we tried a couple of different things there, and people actually did pay for it, which was really interesting. They would actually read the book and go back and make a payment by PayPal. But I think one thing, trying to build up a trust approach with your readers or whatever in the case of films or whatever, your viewers or whatever, so that you have a direct relationship with them and you trust them a little bit more, and kind of cut out the layers and layers that used to stand between the artist and the reader or the viewer. If you can make a direct connection to them, I think they feel that they morally should pay for the work, and they can understand that you have made the put maybe several years of your life into this, and you're not going to be rewarded. You're not going to be able to keep doing it if somebody doesn't, at some point, put some money in your hat. I think people are very happy to rip off corporations, but they're not as happy to rip off artists if they can actually see the artist talking to them. So I think for a lot of smaller record labels, smaller bands, and writers that aren't Stephen King or whatever, in fact, he's actually very good at developing a direct relationship with these readers. But I think we'll have to go more towards a trust-based model, because you will get pirated, you will get copied, you will get versions of your stuff out there. I don't see any digital rights scenario where that's not going to happen. But if you acknowledge that that's going to happen and say, yes, you can copy my stuff, but I do need to eat. There's a strong moral argument that I think you can make, rather than trying to enforce it by law, which is not gonna work.
I've seen surveys and I've seen kind of research people have done, and they, for example, one of the most interesting things has been that people who pirate music, people who download music illegally and who have illegal copies of music, aren't necessarily downloading stuff that they would have bought. And the other thing that turns out is that these people actually do buy significantly more music than, and we're talking about, I suppose, specifically about music here. But there was one piece of research I saw that they, that they buy more music than people who don't download and who don't pirate.
I think that's true. I mean, if I look back at my childhood, you know, I just could not afford albums. So no. I taped tons and tons and tons of albums. But I wasn't taping albums at a cost to the record industry because, you know, if you remember the price of vinyl albums, you know, back in the days of vinyl albums, they were crucifyingly expensive. But a cassette tape was, you know, 10, 15 times cheaper. And you would tape albums that you wouldn't necessarily... you wouldn't even necessarily know if, you like them or not. But the ones that you loved, if you fell in love with an album, then you go out and buy the vinyl. Eventually.
This kind of leads us...
You bought at your capacity. You bought as much as you could afford. But you listened to more than you could afford as a way of finding new stuff. And I think an awful lot of downloaders do this, exactly the same thing.
This kind of leads us into the next thing we were going to talk about. Last week, Google Music was launched as a service in the United States. I've put in some notes about it there. We are not able to get it in Europe yet. It is the latest, I suppose, kind of... an attempt to have a sort of a cloud music service that people can use. Pretty much in Ireland at the moment, the only option, am I right in saying, Michaela, the only option at the moment is iTunes? That's pretty much the only kind of online music service we have. We can't get Spotify. We can't. What do you use yourself, Michaela?
You can get Last.fm.
Can you?
Which is incredibly cheap. I mean, it's about €20 a year or something.
So is that the one with the scrabbling?
Yes.
Yes, I tried that, and it didn't seem to take with me. How does that?
We'll have to talk about that offline. I'll show you the one true way.
How does it work? tell me about it now, Michaela. How does that work, for example?
There's a couple of things you can do. As you're listening to music yourself, you share data with the network, saying, "So listen, you know, I'm listening to music X, whatever it is, track X from artist Y." And over time, their system kind of learns what kind of music I listen to.
But do you get to choose what you listen to? You do.
Well, it works both. You see, it works in two ways.
It'll suggest music to you based on what you've listened to in the past, is it?
Yeah. So, for example, most of the time, I'm playing my own music.
Yeah.
That I've either got the physical CD or I've got the I bought on iTunes or acquired in some other way. But what I can then do is I can go and go, right, well, I don't particularly want to listen to anything I have, so play music for me associated with the tag soundtrack, for example, or music that's like the art, like Killa, or whatever. And it'll do is it won't play stuff by Killa if you choose a specific artist, but it'll choose stuff that's of the same kind of style.
But so essentially what you're doing is you pay a subscription and you get to stream music over the internet for that. And, you know, they have a model and that supports that. But I mean, if you're not online or whatever, that doesn't work that well. And I think that was probably one of my problems with it. You've got to be at your PC. Is there an app for it at the moment or?
You'd have to be at a computer of some kind. I mean, there is an app for the iPhone, but as far as I know, it's restricted to the UK or something strange. Yeah. Not too sure why. I mean, at the moment, the only show in town really for music would be iTunes. I mean, you know, Aircom tried something and so did a couple of the other companies. I can't remember who they were teamed up with. And it never really worked.
They're advertising it kind of heavily at the moment, but it's... And now I don't have an Aircom. We have Aircom at work, but we don't have a residential Aircom account, so I haven't been able to try that out. But you've seen these ads with... what do they call that tune? I can't remember it now. So I mean, there are attempts, I suppose, to have a. What I want really is I want to be able to buy music legally, okay? Whether you subscribe to it or whatever. And I know Apple have Google Music have announced this thing. One of the features of this is that you can upload the music you have; it'll get stored on the cloud. Amazon have offered something similar as well. You can download and have copies, I think, on mobile devices of this. There's also iTunes iMatch. I think they're calling it. Have you come across that, Michele?
Yeah, what you now have on the, if you upgrade your iPhone to the latest version of iOS, which is like iOS 5 point whatever, it knows about all the purchases associated with your iTunes account.
Yes.
So it will do then is it'll you can choose to download all the music.
Yeah.
That you have. Now, they've got this other thing called, oh, I'm sure somebody who's listening to this will actually know the name of it.
Leave a comment.
There's another thing which you can, it allows you to use their system for any music that you've got on your hard drive. So whether you bought it through iTunes or not, but I actually can't remember the name.
I think that's iMatch. I think iMatch is actually allowing that, but I'm not sure. But it's allowing you, I think, to pay a subscription, and you can upload into your cloud storage or your storage locker. You can upload your versions of this. It's difficult, really, because none of these really are available in Ireland yet. What about in Germany, Julian? Have you got more options than we have here?
Germany has some of the same problems Ireland has, but Spotify hasn't been able to open for business in Germany yet. Mm. iTunes is still a fairly dominant player. I get stuff on iTunes. It's interesting seeing that's a really clear example of how the move from the physical object to the digitized, infinitely available object is causing glorious turbulence in the industry. That the whole idea that you have to download a particular file and it's locked on a particular device, and now of course, like you're saying, Google and Apple are saying let's just make it available on every device.
Yes.
And have your music on the cloud. But the music industry is interestingly ahead of all the other ones because the bandwidth is so much bigger for film. But film's going to go in the same direction. I don't see why I will have to own a copy of anything. I think that all the models that are going to work are going to be the equivalent of streaming. You're going to be able to subscribe. This makes much more sense. Mm. I think that's the direction it's going to go in. So anybody who masters that is going to be the king of the jungle.
It's interesting because Amazon and Apple already have deals with the major content providers or with the major labels in the States. And Google, I think, launched last week with three out of four. They don't have Warner on board. What about, are you in the music business at the moment, Julian? I know you were in a band called Toasted Heretic once upon a time.
Yeah.
And you were great fun. I used to play you on the radio years and years.
But we have a ghostly afterlife, so I got a couple of insights into how things are going from that.
Go on.
We have a couple of Toasted Heretic albums available through a lot of digital options because we use CD Baby to sell us physical CDs, and they will put you up on Rhapsody and they put you up on all the various iTunes and all the various streaming services, and a hell of a lot of different. I think they put you up on 50 or 60 of the main services. And it's interesting when you look at your little tiny royalty checks that iTunes absolutely owns the market. I mean, so much more of your revenue comes from iTunes than anywhere else. They're just massively dominant. But the other thing that's happening, which I really like, is I think there's a drift back to vinyl because as you get less and less for your money, downloading digital songs, there's a kind of a I'm seeing a lot of nostalgia for the beautiful objects, a French label just got in contact with us this week actually saying he'd like to do a 500 copy limited edition vinyl reissue for France of our album, of our albums, Another Day, Another Road, and that's fascinating.
What now happens is that we don't need the physical copy anymore, but
just don't need it, yeah.
Except it the value it has is more as a collector's item now, and it's more those kind of special editions that are going
it's
to be valuable.
Like, but there's also a kind of a ritual thing going on when you play a vinyl single or a vinyl album. You actually listen to the music in a way that you don't if you're listening to any of the various digital. Mm. Thingies, you actually have to put the needle in the groove. It's like a religious religious ritual or something, and you find you're listening to music much more intently. I've actually resuscitated a vinyl setup, and I actually listen to most of my music on vinyl now. And a lot of people in Berlin, there's a lot of little record shops in Berlin, and there's a lot of record labels in Berlin that will they'll sell it. They sell the stuff digitally, of course they do, but but they also do limited edition, 10-inch vinyl things and gatefold sleeves that are very beautiful objects. And there's been a big vinyl revival in Berlin in the last few years.
That is fascinating. How bohemian.
So I think it's going to go both ways. I think music's going to get cheaper and cheaper digitally, and more and more completely available. I mean, you just won't be able to not listen to music. But in parallel with that, as a niche, I think the ritual object, the vinyl, probably signed limited editions, written, signed in blood by Ozzy Osbourne, dentist, whatever. That kind of thing that you just simply can't digitize, you can't reproduce, is going to definitely survive and probably thrive, which is unexpected and interesting.
I get the impression that you're a lot more optimistic, Julian, and I won't ask you about this. I'm going to ask you about your optimism again later on in the show, but I get the impression you're a lot more optimistic about the future for artists in the digital world than perhaps some of the lobbyists for the entertainment industry would have us believe. But we're going to talk about that, and we're also going to talk about your work because Minecraft, as we mentioned at the start, has just been the latest edition has just been launched, and you wrote the ending for it. We'll talk about that in a moment. There's a couple of other things I want to get to first. Coder Dojos. Have you heard of these, Julian?
No.
They're fascinating. There's a guy. Is it James Welton? Is it his name? He's a teenager from Cork who's.
Oh, is this the 12-year-old guy?
Well, no. The 12-year-old. No, James isn't. But James, I think, is 18, and he's making waves in the tech community as it is. But one of the ideas that he had, he only, I think, did his Leaving Cert last year. One of the ideas was to roll out across the country the idea of these computer camps or computer clubs for kids, right? And these are the Coder Dojos. He's backed by a guy called Bill Lau, who's a venture capitalist and angel investor. We'll put a link into the story in The Examiner. There is a story there of Harry Moran, who's a 12-year-old Irish Mac Apps coder whose game, it's topped the Mac Apps games chart and beat Angry Birds there quite recently. Pizza Bot, he's called it. What do you think of this, Michele?
I think it's great. I mean, I met James at... I met him at an event there.
Irish Internet Association or something like that, or the
Must have been
Net Vision.
I met him up in Dublin.
Yeah.
And he's very young.
Yeah.
But, he's very mature and he knows what he's at. And we've been kind of involved a little bit. I think we've been helping them out a little bit with giving them some hosting or something. And, it's interesting because it's not one of these kind of, oh, we need to build up the knowledge economy here. Let's throw some money at something kind of thing. It's more... people kind of getting down and dirty and, playing around with code and doing stuff. So I think, it's a fascinating idea. I think it's really working.
That's where the companies eventually come from. It's always the socially awkward kids who didn't do that well in school, having fun and just getting obsessively into something they love. That's ultimately down the line, and who cares? But either way, but that does turn into companies far more so than government initiatives trying to put in infrastructure, blah blah blah. I mean, the real. The real excitement always comes from hairy fuckers in a garage.
Exactly.
Couldn't cut it in university because nobody understood what they were doing. I mean, I did some very interesting stuff recently on Twitter that I was reading about guys, some of the really great little kid coders writing apps for their homework and finding they were getting zeros from their teachers because the teachers couldn't understand what they'd done. Had no way of grading it because the kids were far more advanced than their IT teachers.
Yeah, I mean,
I think dojos are a brilliant way to go because school isn't really, it's not really an ideal environment for those kind of kids, and they need some place outside of it, like great footballers need to be playing, football outside of the school.
Exactly. I mean,
I love these dojos are great. Throw things at it.
Exactly. The motivation that somebody wants to sort of do programming and see what they can make with it. And this has been covered extensively in the Irish media. We link to the article in the Irish Examiner. There's also an article and a video interview, in fact, on siliconrepublic.com in which Harry Moran, the 12-year-old kid from Model Farm Road in Cork, is interviewed. And he literally says, the first question he's asked is, when did you start learning to program? And he says, September. you know?
Great.
Now, I don't know about you, Julian, but in terms of plans I might have had in September to launch something shortly or to learn a new skill and put it into effect, to go from September to the middle of November and find yourself at the top of the Mac apps chart. It's available as a Mac app at the moment. According to the article in The Examiner, it's going to be out as an iPhone and iPad app as well very shortly. It's a game
called... Everything's faster now. Yeah. Everything really is faster.
Yeah. Let's move on. Michaela, something you got excited about last night was Google Real-Time Analytics, and I've seen other people this morning talking about the same thing. This is the latest beta feature in Google Analytics. If you own or run your own website and you use Google Analytics to monitor traffic on that, you can now see literally who's on your site right now.
Yeah, I mean, this is... I'm trying to think of something intelligent to say apart from, ooh, wow.
That's good enough.
It's... I mean, okay, sure. If you've got one of those websites that gets, 50 visitors a month and...
Yeah, I was going to say that. I was looking on some of my sites and they're just not getting the traffic to see. I could be waiting there all day and nobody would visit,
But, well, I didn't want to bring that up, Con.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay.
If you have a website that actually does reasonable levels of traffic, and by reasonable I'm talking, several hundred thousand page impressions per month. Mm. This actually is very, very cool.
Yeah.
I logged into this last night. I was playing around with a couple of my own personal ones. I was kind of looking and going, oh, yeah, that's grand. Then I switched over to some of the company ones and I went, oh, my God, wow.
Right.
It shows you things like, okay, how many people are on your website at any given moment in time? How many of them are new visitors? How many are returning? How many got there via search? How many went there directly? How many did you actually pay for to get there? How many were referred from another website? It does this beautifully visually. And I'm looking at this now at the moment. I'm kind of going, on this particular website, I've got 30-something users, of which, 10% we were paying for, 10% are... referred from another site, and 16% got there through organic search. I'm like, ooh, cool.
The thing that's kind of interesting, one of the features that they mentioned on the page about it is that it's a good way if you're doing social media, or if you're, for example, if you're tweeting, doing Twitter marketing, or if something happens in real time, which you want to see the response to, this can be useful. For example, if you tweeted about a new page on your site or a new offer on your company site, Michaela, you could literally see what kind of response that was generating in real time.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, it's one of the major failings with the older version of Google Analytics today is you're waiting between 12 and 24 hours before you see any data. Whereas even if you're using, say, AWStats or one of the open source things, if you're running your own servers, which you would be for a larger e-commerce operation anyway, you could just increase the frequency at which it parses the logs. So, we used to use AWStats on some sites, and you'd have them updating every 5 or 10 minutes. It wouldn't be as real time as this, but it would give you, pretty accurate, because it's only going to be a couple of minutes old. But what this is giving me is actual live view, so I can literally see people moving through a website. I can see traffic spiking on certain pages due to certain things. So could be due to an emailing, could be due to a tweet, a Facebook post, both positive and negative. And I mean the real time stuff is really, really cool. But there's also a lot of other stuff in there that they've done, things like this visitor flow thing. I don't know if you looked at that yet. I'm just kind of going, oh my God, this is so cool. I'm losing the ability to make coherent sentences. But what it does is it gives you things like, okay, The bulk of your visitors are coming from, country X or country Y or region X or region Y. And then it shows, which pages are they going to and which pages they're going to from those pages. And they're starting to use language that you don't need to be a Google Analytics guru to actually understand, to get your head around.
Yeah. Let's move on and a little kind of, and finally, you blogged about this on technology.ie the other day. Code cards, Michaela. Christmas cards for geeks, specifically for... I suppose, people like 12-year-old Harry Moran and people like that who are interested in code. Little in-jokes for programmers, I suppose, is what you'd say some of these are. There, it's on the site there at technology.ie. The one you featured was a recipe in PHP data declarations for...
Or eggnog or something.
Eggnog. So $ egg yolks equals 12. So we assign the value 12 to the egg yolks variable. Pounds of sugar, assign the value 1. And that's basically... My favourite one actually was the CSS Happy New Year. That's there as well.
I mean, just the thing is this, is like, you know, we send out Christmas cards from the company to some of our clients and suppliers. Yeah. You know, it's one of those things, you know, who do you send it out to? What do you send them?
And many of your clients and suppliers, Michele, are kind of technologically, they'd appreciate these kind of in-jokes.
Some of them would, not all of them. I mean, it's the same with RealX Payments. They did a T-shirt there, I think about 2 years ago, which was, I don't know if you saw it, it was an SQL statement.
Mm. Right.
So it was something like, select from payment providers where... quality equals awesome or right. something like that, which I thought, you know, you don't need to be a hardcore geek to get that,
yeah,
but you do need to be a bit of a geek to get it.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I thought, not just, you know, I think this, you know, doing stuff a little bit differently, you know, ye old reindeer and yeah. red nosed Santa does get a bit boring.
It does, yeah. Julian, I mean, you're a writer, you're a musician, you're a creative artist. Does your interest in technology extend to coding PHP and things like that?
I'm not a good coder. I very occasionally try and write a couple of lines of,
yeah.
Code on my website, but I really am not a proper coder. My theoretical interest in it is huge, but my actual ability to do it is limited. I mean, when I was a kid, I had a, you know, I wrote my own programs in BASIC and that, so I'm not scared of going behind the interface and poking around, but I'm not able to do it anymore. I didn't stay up to date with everything because you can't, but I do poke around the whole time.
But I got the impression reading your blog, Julian, that, and specifically there's we talked about this earlier, there's a rant you published there, which was your thoughts on the state of literature, of, let's say, modern Irish literature in particular.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
And, you know, it was published in The Guardian, and there was a lot of quotes and a lot of extensively, yeah. I suppose, quoted in that and responded to. And I think
there's
generally was,
yeah.
was generally viewed as a good thing in many ways, Julian, that you put the cat among the pigeons and start things up a little bit. But one of the points that I kind of picked up explicitly in that thing, and also somewhat between the lines, is that you feel that digital culture is part of the culture nowadays. It's part of the, you know, you don't necessarily have to be a full-time programmer or someone like that. You know, you're a guy, as you say, who played around with BASIC in the 1980s and who has an appreciation of that. And you feel that modern art and modern literature needs to reflect that as well.
Oh, hugely! Yeah, yeah. I mean, the digital revolution changes everything. And but my problem, I suppose, with the Irish literary scene is because it hasn't changed, that it kind of pretends electricity never happened. And it definitely pretends most of the time that the internet never happened. Now, this is less true of like guys like the crime novelists and that, who kind of do write about modern Ireland. But the serious literary authors, the sort of people that get win the Booker Prize or whatever, they have a huge freedom to write anything they want. And I felt a bit annoyed, I think, over the last few years that they retreated from the modern world, because they even the guys that used to write about punk rock and when punk rock was happening, or the aftermath of it, or that suddenly they were writing novels about emigration, and they were writing novels about the famine, and they were writing novels about the Easter Rising in the last decade. You know, I felt that they missed a chance to tell us something interesting maybe about the world we live in, because we don't have perspective. The rate of change is so fast, and we don't know where it's going. I mean, a lot of the things we were talking about tonight, it was really what will happen now that they've done this. Is this the right thing to do? What are the implications of this in the future? We're talking about future all the time without knowing what's going to what it's going to be.
I am going to ask you more about that and maybe some examples of international writers who you think perhaps are engaging with that digital culture. First of all, though, I want to talk specifically, you know, the podcast technology.ie is sponsored by Michele's company, Black Knight. And we briefly talked about this last week, Michele, which was the new cloud hosting product that you've introduced. You announced that, of course, during the week. You've also included it in your newsletter. And I've seen you've got a lot of questions, comments on that. People are very interested in what you're offering.
Yeah, I mean, the feedback so far has been very, very positive. And it's early days with something like this for us because, you know, it's a new type of product and service. But there's definite interest from people. And, you know, the thing is, we have a certain reputation, which means that, you know, people are going to go, ah, excellent, you guys are offering this. I don't have to go to one of your competitors. And I'm like, yeah, well, that's why we're offering it. So it's good. I've got a couple of people who've asked, you know, to get set up with test accounts so they can try it out and maybe review it for us. And the guys down in the Batcave, as we like to refer to them, are working on adding new features. So hopefully in the not too distant future, we'll be able to do the kind of more flexible thing where you'll be able to kind of sign up for a certain number of resources, you know, a certain amount of RAM, certain amount of disk space, and certain amount of CPU and all that. And, you know, get cracking with it. I mean, I've been playing with myself as well a little bit since I'm a very strong believer in eating my own dog food. And what I love about it is this thing. I can play around with a Debian virtual machine. If I don't like it, I can replace it with a CentOS one, or I can replace it with an Ubuntu one. And it only takes a couple of minutes, or less than that, really, for it to go off. Destroy one cloud machine and run and start another one up, or even use one of the Jumpbox kind of application appliance virtual machines. And, you know, you can get up and running with everything installed and working for a particular application in a couple of minutes. And you've just, it's quick crack.
And you've made the point that, you know, these are virtual machines and you've had VPS offerings before, but this is different. This is a truer virtual server technology.
It's a different type of technology. I mean, you know, we were one of the first companies to offer any kind of virtualization in the Irish market going back, you know, geez, must be 6-7 years ago. We tried out one particular type of technology. It kind of worked. Then we tried out another one, and it worked, but it had certain limitations. This one, it's a next iteration. It's using Xen with certain things thrown on top of it. So you can access certain functionality. And, you know, as an end user, you don't have to worry about what's going on in the background. It just happens. You know, click button, it happens, boom, done. This is the thing with these kind of technologies. It's a bit like, you know, with Apple, you know, you're hiding the guts of it. You don't need to know about that.
Where can people find out more?
Just go on to our website. It's on the main page.
Okay.
If you go to the main page, you'll see the little cloud hosting thing on the main page of the website.
You've got a huge range there, starting from, I think it's standard and going up to business and business plus and up to enterprise. Starting at what kind of price for a virtual server of your very own?
$12.99 a month. XFAT.
Excellent.
Technology.ie is brought to you by Ireland's premier hosting and domain registration company, Black Knight. Black Knight offer a comprehensive range of hosting and domain solutions for businesses of all shapes and sizes, no matter where they are in the world.
You're listening to the Technology.ie podcast with Con and Michele, and our special guest this week, Julian Goff, novelist and musician, and somebody who knows quite a bit about technology as well, as we've been talking. Julian, thanks for joining us. I'm going to ask you in a moment to tell me about your latest, one of your latest gigs, which was writing the ending for Minecraft, which is the online game, which has been, the latest version of it has just been released. First, I want to refer to some comments on the site. If anybody wants to get in touch with us, they may do so through the site. There's a contact form there at technology.ie, and you can also leave your comments, as Owen did, left a couple of comments there in response to not our last show, but I think the one before that, and he was talking there. We'll link these in the notes to go with this program as well. We've asked people how they listen to the podcast. Owen is like myself. He's an Android phone user, so he's using Dog Catcher, but he has a feature which I don't have, which is that he's filtering and managing those podcast that he's subscribing on Dogcatcher. He's filtering those through Google Reader first, which is an interesting way of doing it, and certainly gives you a more flexible way of managing things. He's also critical of Google Plus, Michele, as you were when we spoke there 2 weeks about it, 2 weeks ago about it. Google Plus, the inability to have, for example, more than one account to administer your page, or indeed if you have multiple Google Plus, if you have multiple Google IDs, such as I have, you can't necessarily share information between them or attach them to the same Google Plus account.
Yeah, which is really annoying.
Yeah, yeah. Have you used Google Plus, Julian?
Yeah, I have, but I haven't really migrated to it. I played around with it at first. I really liked some of the interface. I thought the circles thing was just really sweet, very intuitive, and it solved a problem which you have exactly, on Twitter, and which you really have on Facebook, because even though you can break things down into various lists, it's bloody hard to do. You have that. Google Plus would have been great if it came out a couple of years ago, and I would have, definitely, I think, gone for it ahead of Twitter. But I've just invested so much time on Twitter, and I have so many relationships there, that I just don't have enough spare time to set up Google Plus properly. I do like it, though. I hope it hangs around, and I hope when I get a bit of headspace, I have a couple of things I've finished writing. I do want to spend a few days or a couple of weeks.
See, this is the thing. I don't know if
Google Plus a bit more. I don't have time for all, for building a whole new social network. But I do like a lot of what it does. I can see the problems for people who want for the business of that. They're kind of not really set it up right for that.
But this is the thing, Julian. I mean, you said when I get a bit of time, I intend to sort of explore Google Plus. Isn't that turning things on its head? Shouldn't these social networks serve us and slot into our lifestyles and not the other way around? I mean, really, if you think about it, that's, it's not really the way to, I really must work on my Google Plus is not really how this kind of stuff should be, really.
Well, realistically, you do have to put a bit of time into establishing your relationship with a social network. And I do like some of the things it tells me, because I love Twitter, but there are tweets you send and you think, okay, I would like to be able to just not send this to everybody from my mum to my exes to my closest friends to casual readers of my books. It's not appropriate for everybody. And that kind of, in a way, narrows you down. I like the way Google Plus allows you to express different parts of your personality to different groups of people that know you in different ways. So that's quite a nice feature. I wish Twitter and Facebook did that better. And that's what draws me towards Google Plus.
In a way, I think it doesn't matter so much with Twitter, in the sense that we just throw it all out there, and
it's become very acceptable.
Well, because it's so
more of allowances for people.
Yeah, and because it's so brief, I think it doesn't it doesn't clutter anyone's timeline up too much. I mean, I have a thing, for example, where I initially maintained two separate, because I do a lot of activity in Irish online as well. I initially had a Twitter account that I only tweeted in Irish on, and another one that I tweeted in English on, and I discovered that I couldn't divide my thoughts in that way. So now I just throw it all out on
features.
Now I just throw it all out.
The lovely thing about Twitter is it's I think it's almost, in a way, educated people in how complicated other human beings are. I think there's a lot of forgiveness on Twitter, which I like. You're allowed to be in a bad mood for a day, and you're allowed to talk an Irish reassurance.
Exactly. You mentioned Facebook there. Do you use that at all, Julian, or is it as important to you as Twitter, for example?
I don't really use Facebook much at all. Partly because in the early days when I just accepted requests from everybody, and I've ended up with a complete mess of an account where tabloid journalists and relatives and friends are all mixed in together, and there's very little I want to say that would be appropriate for all of them. So I actually don't use it very often.
As a writer, how do you find the 140 character limit?
Infuriating, difficult, and very good for me. Very good for me. I think I've become a better editor since I've spent a lot of time on Twitter. I'm very aware of how much you can cut a sentence down and still have it work. I think it's definitely improved my line-by-line editing on my
It's almost like a poetic constraint, really, isn't it? In the sense that you've got to poetry has to fit within a meter of some kind. These are like, I don't know how it corresponds to a haiku, for example.
Well, it does. It forces you to think more clearly.
Yeah.
Because you can't get away with a sloppy thought on Twitter because it falls off the end.
Yeah.
So it actually, I think, helps you to think. I quite like Twitter.
Some people
negative effects, but
some people think it's, you know, this is ruining our language, and we're
nonsense. Yeah. They probably said that about, you know, they can, you know, the invention of fire. I mean, it's not ruining our language. It's changing it. But I think there's many, many positives, and overall the positives like negatives. I definitely think it helps me think, and I definitely think it helps me edit.
This is what I wanted to talk to you about, Julian, was, I suppose, how someone like you, who appreciates technology and yet is a novelist, is a creative artist, do you see, let's talk about the specific thing, which is that you can write novels, you can write short stories, you can write poetry traditionally. Now you can write, and of course for years you can write screenplays, you can write for the movies, you can write for the stage, and you've just written for a computer game.
Yeah, well,
how did that happen?
That was Twitter.
That was through Twitter. We're talking about Minecraft, which is it's a game where you can go in, you can build your own environment. Now, I haven't played it. I'm told it's similar in some ways to Second Life, and that it allows you to sort of build things inside there. It didn't strike me as a game that had a purpose or had an ending or required an ending, but it seems it does, and you were approached, as you say, through Twitter. How did that happen?
Well, yeah, I think you're right. In a way, Minecraft doesn't need an ending. But some people want an ending. I think some people who play games feel that they need to go somewhere and do something and achieve something and find closure on it. So there's an ending there for people that want an ending, and other people that just want to, you know, build insane things and play forever on it can still do that. So I like the way it was thought of by one guy called Notch. His real name's Marcus Persson. He's a Swedish developer, and he developed Minecraft a couple of years ago. And I hadn't realized I bumped into him, but he was out in Berlin for a thing called Big Jam, which is a little indie game developer thing that happens in a cafe around the corner from us. And there's, you know, 30 or 40 or 50 developers from all over the world, and I was there before it was even in beta testing it. And because of that, we had some friends in common on Twitter. So he was asking, he sent out a tweet saying, "I'm looking for a talented writer. Famous would be a plus to do a crazy ending for Minecraft," because he decided he wanted to have an ending on the game for the people that want an ending. And I got recommended by a couple of people. So I didn't know I was getting recommended. I didn't know he'd sent the tweet. So I got an email saying, "Do you want to write the ending to Minecraft?" And he gave me a wide open brief.
Wow.
And it was a very interesting thing to try and do, because it's got like I think it sold 4 million copies already, and it's like 16 million registered players. So there's a huge community that have a really deep relationship with the game. So you want to respect their view of what the game is, but also do something kind of creative or interesting. So it's an interesting challenge.
Was it very different?
I'm not used to.
How did it compare to the kind of work you would have done previously?
Well, I mean, all the things you mentioned, I've kind of done them. I've written, you know, I've published a book of poetry. I've written a film screenplay. I've written for theatre and written radio plays for the BBC. And I really like writing. I really like trying new things. So. And I think there's a continuity between all of them. They're not really as separate as you'd think. And because I wasn't writing the game per se, I wasn't really, you know, Marcus wrote the game, and it's a game I really like, and I have actually, you know, I played it and I like it. But what I had to do was really find a way to finish it in a satisfying way. So I didn't go back into the game and mess around with it. I could just write a story, really, for the credits at the end. He wanted a story. He wanted a piece of high-quality narrative, that's what he asked for, at the end. So I really wrote a story that I think makes for a nice ending to the game. Because you're in a funny space when you finish a computer game that you spent, you know, maybe months on. You're really immersed in this world. And then you have to come back out into the real world, and there's this kind of shock where you have to leave one world and go into another, but I think makes you quite receptive to slightly more philosophical or poetic language than you'd have in your ordinary life. So I tried to write something that was, a little bit that played with people's view of reality a little bit, that played with their sense of what's real and what's not, and how amazing and strange the universe is. You know, the universe in Minecraft is a square sun, and then you're back into this one.
This is something. This is something, and we alluded to this earlier, Julian, in relation to your critique of, I suppose, the Irish literary establishment, let's say.
And I shouldn't slag them off too much, because they do write wonderful stuff. It's just, exactly. My problem is that they write wonderful stuff that could have been written 100 years ago.
And the thing is, as well, is that a lot of people, and I have to say, this is, I do tend to come at this myself from a rather, while I'm very interested in technology, I have tended to not really play games, and it's mostly because I found them very addictive. And realised that I'd be up all night for weeks slaughtering aliens and things like that. So for that reason, but at the same time, now my kids are grown up and they're into games, and I'm getting right back into that stuff again. But it is an area that I think a lot of people would sort of entirely and completely discount in terms of an artistic or cultural activity. But you don't feel that way about it. I mean, would you say...
I think they've got tremendous potential. I mean, I don't think they've fully tapped it. Of course, I think really, you know, computer games are at the stage that you know, that films were at. Mm. You know, maybe, you know, at the same age. You know, like 10 or 20 years after whatever they'd started. We're still in sort of black and white, silent film era. Really, in a lot of ways, we haven't really worked out what's the grammar of a computer game. What kind of structures are possible? What kind of storytelling is possible? What kind of ways can you what kind of art can you make? What kind of entertainment can you make?
Well, there's the question right there. There's the question right there. Is it art? I mean, what can you?
It can be, and it doesn't have to be. Right. I think it's a fake division to say it's either just trashy entertainment, or it could be just art, and it's a shame it's trashy entertainment. I think it's going to be a spectrum. It's always going to be a spectrum. At one end, you're going to have art. At the other end, you're going to have trash. And you're also going to have trashy art, and you're going to have arty trash, and you're going to have a whole bunch of different mixed-up versions of those elements. It's going to be a spectrum. But at the moment, I think the spectrum's a bit tight. It's all bunched up around some similar ways of telling stories, some similar ways of structuring games, especially in the mainstream. You know, I mean, if you look at the way the graphics have developed, the sounds developed, the physics engines have developed over the last 20 years, and then you look at the way storytelling has developed. I think storytelling is the weak area in computer games. It hasn't developed remotely as much, and there's a horrible gap between the literary writers that I like and the computer game world. Yeah, they don't really talk to each other. It's basically developers and coders are coming up with a lot of the stories now. That
is this something you would like to see, Julian, then? What you're really saying is, wouldn't it be great to see the literary community, to see literary writers put their shoulders to the wheel in relation to computer games, and perhaps put the input that other artists have already put into computer games? We could then say perhaps that we have an emerging art form.
Oh, it's already an emerging art form. I think there's some lovely games out there, some really interesting games. There's some good art games out there. There's a lot of indie developers doing weird little things that most people just aren't aware of. They're very pretty and interesting and thought-provoking. But, I mean, I'm not even sure if literary writers are the best. I don't know if I want the current lot of literary writers to move into games, because I'm not sure if they'd be able to add much to it. I'm not sure if they would get it. What I do think I'd like to see is the kind of kids that grew up to be literary writers 20, 30, 50 years ago, getting into games. I mean, imagine if Ernest Hemingway was developing a war game.
Yeah.
I think it'd be quite an interesting thing, you know. Imagine if, what kind of writers do you like? Who do you...
Imagine the Coder Dojo kids of today growing up to become writers and having that dual sensibility.
It would be great, yeah, because I think there's a tendency for the coders to just code and never bother reading a book. And, well, although they just read science fiction or whatever, they can just read a couple of tight versions of books. And the readers to read, you know, get lost in literature and fall in love with the romance of literature, and it's all very old-fashioned and handle it, and they don't really get stuck into the coding. And the interesting thing is going to happen when kids that are comfortable in both start trying to write games. Not trying to write games and not trying to write novels, trying to write something that's not a film, not a novel, not a game. It's a new thing. And I think the new thing is what I'm missing, though. That I'm hungry for the new thing that isn't a first-person shooter and isn't a science fiction novel and isn't a film about relationships, but it takes all the interesting stuff that we've developed in all the art forms and makes the new thing. And that, I think, is going to come in the next few years. There's going to be stuff that you won't be able to really call it a game or film or book. It'll be digital. You'll be involved in it in a very immersive way, and it won't probably be. I don't know what it'll be, but there's kids out there that are probably starting to write it now.
So
I'd love to be involved.
Something I said I'd ask you earlier as well was who you thought perhaps had this name that popped into my head now, particularly in relation to his writing about technology and writing about science fiction, I suppose, in a way, but also in terms of his attitude to copyright and or the lack of it. Cory Doctorow is someone I thought of there.
I was talking to him last week in Berlin.
Right.
I do like him a lot. That's a small fan.
Yes.
Yeah, he was meeting in a cafe in Berlin there last week, and I was chatting after the gig.
Yeah.
Yeah, no, I was a big fan of him. I've sent the old thing to Boing Boing, and
who else would be that you think gets it in terms of, I suppose, embracing the digital in their art?
Well, there's a writer, one writer I think I would love to see do a video game, get involved with some developers, would be Jonathan Levin. I don't know if you know Jonathan Levin's work, but he wrote that She Moves Across the Table, which is about a university that develops a black hole, and one of the researchers falls in love with the black hole. That's a great book. And he wrote Chronic Cities, his most recent one, I think,
right.
Set in New York, and he wrote the Fortress of Solitude, which is about kids growing up on comics in Brooklyn. Mm. He's really influenced by science fiction, by Philip K. Dick. He's really influenced by comics, Golden Age, kind of Fantastic Four, Stan Lee, Jack Kirby kind of comics, and he's a fascinating guy. He's very alive to the modern world. I'd love to see a game by him.
What do you think, Michaela? I know that you're into movies in particular, and you're into games and that as well. Is this all too highbrow, or are we? Would you hope to see some kind of more engagement between artists and the technology side of things?
I think there already is to a certain degree. I mean, if you look at, a couple of my staff are big gamers. I mean, they take the gaming very, very, very seriously, whereas I wouldn't. I mean, for me, it's just a kind of a mild diversion, a bit like you. I can end up wasting a ridiculous amount of time on it if I'm not careful. I was looking at one of the promotional videos for a particular game. And it was like Hollywood production values.
Yeah.
And I was going, wow, this is what now? This is a film? This is what? Mm. I was like, no, it's a game. Really. And I'm going, whoa. So I think, we're already there. Yeah, I think it's going to change over time. I mean, I don't have a coherent thought on that really, I suppose.
Speaking of time, we've gone way over, and it's absolutely...
We have.
We'll probably cut this down a little bit more so it'll fit fit onto people's iPods and that. I want to thank you very much, Julian, for coming on. It's been absolutely fascinating. Before we go, Michaela, you wanted to talk about Black Friday just before we go, very briefly. That's coming up on this Friday, which is it's the day after Thanksgiving in the United States, and it's traditionally a day when people tend to see a spike in Christmas shopping and things like that. We talk about physically, don't we, Michaela, in terms of the fact that there are stampedes and sometimes tragic ones at shopping malls and things like that, but also there's a good deal of sort of online thing, and for example it's one of the days when the geeks go home to visit their parents and upgrade their antivirus and do things like that for them as well.
But there's a couple of interesting things with it. I mean, if you're looking for a bargain from Amazon or any of the other big online e-commerce sites, then it's one of the best days of the year. But it's a bit like, the post-Christmas sales we have, where it's like kind of, let's get those wonderful deals, and then you arrive there and discover that they're not that great. But it's an interesting one, because if you are running a website that is targeting the US market, then it's going to be one of the biggest days of the year for you.
Is it something that you, Black Knight, are involved in, or do you notice any business from it?
Not directly, no. But it's we would have clients who are targeting the US market, so their bandwidth usage and things like that might go up.
You can see that.
But I did notice, for example, that PrinceAugust.ie who do a lot of business overseas, they sent out a mailer earlier today offering, I think it was free shipping or something for Black Friday, which I thought to myself, you know, that's gutsy.
Absolutely. They're based in County Cork, aren't they?
Yes. Here it is. Zero postage to the USA until Monday 28th.
Yeah. Do you remember those?
Black Friday is the day following Thanksgiving in the US, traditionally the beginning of the Christmas shopping season. Prince August and Mithra are offering free postage to the USA mainland from November 23rd to 28th.
They're a company that supply modelling, lead modelling soldiers and things like that. Isn't that right?
They also do... they do some very cool kind of, you know, pre-made stuff, which is, you know, very, very funky.
Right. It's very interesting. And as I said, Julian, it's been great to have you on the show. The very best of luck with everything. Where can people find out more about what you're doing?
JulianGough.com is the website, but I hang out on Twitter much more, so just talk to me on Twitter. At Julian Gough.
All right, that's where you'll find us all. Julian Gough on Twitter. M. Neelan is Michele on Twitter, and I'm Con on Twitter. This is the show on technology.ie, sponsored by Black Knight. Thanks to Michele and to Black Knight, and of course to our guest this week, Julian. Until next week, slán go fóill. We'll talk to you then.